have with us live in the studios once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, a lot to cover today. Lots to cover.
Let's go for it.
Okay. All right, here we go. Beginning with local and Mayor Mike McGinn.
Yeah, this week, Mayor Mike McGinn, early in the week, I think it was on Monday, he made some transportation proposals. The first one was he went to the city council and he made a proposal for a bond levy to replace the waterfront seawall. His proposal was a 30-year levy of 0.12 cents per 1,000 assessed property value, which means about $12 for every 100,000 assessed property value. And he figures that will bring in about $15 million per year to help pay for a replacement for the deteriorating waterfront seawall. And he made the proposal to the city council, and they will look at it in July and decide in July whether it should go to the ballot in November for people to vote on. He made a couple of other proposals this week, too. He said that as part of his September budget proposal, he's going to include an increase in the 10% parking tax for downtown for city lots by 2.5% in order to pay for improvements to the Mercer Corridor West expansion. Now, the East expansion, the Mercer Beautification Project, the money's already been set aside for that, unless, of course, it goes into cost overruns. That money has not been set aside. But the city council is moving ahead, gung-ho on this expansion west of the Seattle Center. They want to, add additional lanes all the way over to Elliott. And he's hoping that a parking tax increase will bring in an additional $5 million per year to help with that. $5 million a year isn't a whole lot, and my guess is they're going to have to look elsewhere for more money for that. In addition, his third proposal is he wants to create a new local improvement district downtown to help pay for waterfront and surface street improvements that would go along with replacing the Alaskan Way Viaduct with a tunnel. Now, the state has committed to paying for the tunnel, except for cost overruns, which is a whole nother issue. But the city still has to come up with the money, hopefully around $225 million or perhaps more, to pay for downtown surface street improvements and improvements to the waterfront that go along with that. And he's hoping that this local improvement district, basically composed of downtown, will help pay for most of that. And again, my guess is that's not going to happen either.
Yeah, even though the property values along the waterfront, because it'll open up and because the Alaska Way Viaduct will come down, will be escalating dramatically. And that was a linchpin of the original proposals for a surface option to replace the viaduct, is to tax the waterfront property owners. But just because they'll benefit massively from this doesn't mean they'll actually be expected to pay for it.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that they'll go along with this proposal. I mean, who controls the city council in this town, Most of the members are answerable to the Downtown Business Association, so you can see where that's headed. Another interesting thing that happened this week in transportation issues is what happened in the City Council's Transportation Committee the next day. They voted to restrict the mayor from spending money on his transit master plan. Now, the city has a transit master plan, and it's the plan that McGinn has inherited from Greg Nichols. And, of course, that transit plan focuses heavily on expanding the streetcar system in the city of Seattle. Well, McGinn wants to revise that plan. He wants to spend some money looking at alternative transit forms of transit, and he has suggested that the city might want to build a light rail line that connects to the current light rail line and would carry passengers out to West Seattle and up to Ballard.
You know, where the monorail was going to go.
Yeah, where the monorail was going to go. And the response from Tom Rasmussen, who heads the Transportation Committee, was a surprise and a little bit of shock. He thinks that light rail should only be a regional system, and that the city should look instead at trolleys, streetcars, buses, etc. But come on, let's be realistic here. The city has for decades left all of the bus planning to the county, and the county's priorities are really obvious. They have spent the last several years at least expanding bus services to the suburbs, and they've ignored a lot of the in-city routes. Any in-city routes that have gotten increases in bus service, have been few, and it's been far between. So the city really has to. I mean, that's why Greg Nichols said, let's go ahead with the streetcar plan, because Metro is not providing decent in-city service. We need alternative transit here within the city to serve the city's neighborhoods. Well, McGinn is looking at Sound Transit's light rail line, because unlike the South Lake Union Trolley, the light rail line, even though it's not finished, even though it doesn't go all the way to the airport, has exceeded ridership estimates.
Yeah, it does actually go to the airport now.
Well, it does actually now, yeah, but it's not, you know, it only goes from downtown to the south neighborhoods. Yeah. Probably the least number of riders that were projected for the North Gate to airport line, and yet it's gaining 1,000 new riders every month. And the estimate was the what they had hoped for was 26,000 riders by the end of 2010. Well, it's already past the 20,000 ridership mark, and it's well on its way to exceeding that estimate. So he's looking at, you know, he looks at the light rail line, a very successful transit option that actually moves people, unlike the South Lake Union Trolley, which has largely helped, you know, revive Paul Allen's South Lake Union properties.
And, it's an elephant. It's white.
Yeah, and hasn't really been successful. It's been actually a massive failure in terms of if you take it in terms of transit and moving people around. The light rail line has been very successful at that. So McGinn's proposal is a good one to link up in-city neighborhoods with the light rail line. It doesn't have to just be a regional transportation system, and yet the city council is digging in its heels and saying no. So I found that very interesting. And I'm urging people to contact Tom Rasmussen and the other members of the City Council Transportation Committee and say, why don't we study light rail for in-city neighborhoods?
All right. Moving on, Attorney General Rob McKenna.
Yeah, if there was any doubt from his lawsuit, his joining of the Republican lawsuit against the Obama's health care reform bill, as to whether he is placing more emphasis on running for governor in 2012 or actually executing his duties as attorney general for the state. Well, we got an answer to that this week. He's been refusing to defend the Department of Natural Resources headed by Democrat Peter Goldmark again in a suit against it by the Okanagan County Public Utility District, which wants to use the right of eminent domain to take some state land and that is, you know, used by the state for income for schools and, you know, cut down the trees and use that land for transmission lines. The DNR wants to stop that proposal because of environmental concerns. And, McKenna, as Attorney General for the state, one of his statutory requirements is to represent different agencies and departments of the state government in lawsuits against it by outside parties.
Whether he agrees with it or not.
Whether he agrees with it or not. That's absolutely correct. And so what McKenna is doing is actually quite illegal. And the fact that our local conservative daily newspaper, the Seattle Times, is not choosing to report on this is another interesting angle of this, because, you know, if nobody's aware that McKenna is actually pulling these kind of shenanigans, then it has no cost to him politically, and he can turn around and use it and say, you know, I wouldn't let the environmentalists run the state when he runs for governor in 2012. So this is kind of disturbing behavior, because it means that his statutory obligation to represent state agencies is going out the window whenever he finds it politically expedient, and that is not kosher.
Yeah, and you know, I think someone ought to look at how we can kick him out of office, if there's a way to impeach him or get him kicked out of office, and start some kind of initiative or whatever, you know, the state constitution requires.
Yeah, it's people looked into that actually when the lawsuit was launched, and it's very, very difficult to impeach or recall him at this point.
Wow.
But certainly you can start raising money for whoever runs against him in 2012.
Yeah, or maybe we ought to start something that allows you know, a way to change the Constitution so that becomes a little bit easier when you have a public official who does this sort of thing.
All right. Well, speaking of initiative, we have an update on Initiative 1068.
Yeah, the initiative that would decriminalize marijuana possession across the state got some bad news this week. They had been in talks for several weeks with SEIU, the Surface Employees International Union, and local Democratic Party officials about getting the money to help with paid signature gadgets, which is virtually required in order these days in order to get an initiative on the ballot. And Tim Iman uses paid signature gatherers. A lot of the the corporate-backed initiatives certainly use paid signature gatherers. But 1068 has been all volunteer run so far. So far, they've got over 100,000 signatures, but by the end of the month, they need to get well over 200,000. And so time is short, and they're running out of time. And with paid signature gatherers, they almost certainly would be on the ballot in November. And polling is showing that once it would be on the ballot, then that we would have decriminalized marijuana in this state. Well, the pitch was that particularly with Senator Murray facing a strong reelection challenge, it would have been to the Democratic Party's interest to bring out more voters who are strongly motivated about an initiative like this. And certainly that's been a factor in their support of 1098, which is the high earners income tax initiative, which is also trying to get on the ballot for November. But they backed away, and one of the reasons they backed away is behind the scenes opposition by the ACLU, which has also been a major player in anti-drug war organizing in Washington State. And this sort of internecine squabbling between various decriminalization advocates has really undercut the chances for 1068 to be successful this fall, which is a real shame.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Moving on to national and some business executives weighing in this week on where research dollars should be going.
Yeah, there was a group of business executives this week that called for the U.S. government to triple its spending on basic research in new forms of energy. And the group leader was Bill Gates, co-founder of Microsoft. But it included other executives who have worked for companies like GE, DuPont, Xerox, Lockheed Martin, and several other very well-known national corporations and international corporations. And what was interesting is that they acknowledged the need for an 80% reduction in greenhouse gases. I found that very interesting, since a lot of businesses and CEOs don't acknowledge that need. But their solution, of course, was not conservation, one of the biggest pieces of any kind of plan to reduce greenhouse gases. Their solution is strictly a technological one, and that's very similar to how the Gates Foundation works on world health issues. They really concentrate, you know, not on simple grassroots democratic solutions or ways to improve people's standard of living in the third world, but they really look at breakthrough drugs and technology as the solution. And of course, that has its limits. Right now, the U.S. government currently spends about $5 billion per year on new forms of energy. But if you look at it, you really have to ask, okay, who is profiting from the money that's currently being spent? Who wins government grants, you know, and who really can lobby the government in order to get this money? That's not going to change if you increase it threefold. You're going to still have examples like the corn lobby working so hard to get tons of money spent on ethanol, which is really a dead end in terms of new forms of energy.
All right. Well, speaking of energy, this week's update on the ever-expanding oil spill.
Yeah, on the other side of the equation, you have the urgency of the oil spill in the Gulf pushing us to think about other forms of energy besides, you know, business as usual. It was pretty clear this week with the cap in place and BP saying that they were collecting some 15,000 barrels per day of oil, that, and we were still seeing huge amounts of oil escaping from the vents in the cap, that clearly the current government estimates of 12,000 to 19,000 gallons or barrels per day leaking was low. That was really clear. But what's interesting is that a government panel that's been tasked with putting a real figure on how much is leaking out of the well, they came forward this week and they doubled the official government estimate of the leak up to 25,000 to 30,000 barrels per day. And that means we're getting the equivalent of one Exxon Valdez spilled into the Gulf about every 8 to 10 days. But I want to point out that was based on measurements taken before BP actually cut the riser pipe. So, you know, and everyone has said, pretty much all the experts agree, that once they cut the riser pipe, the leak increased. Nobody knows quite how much it increased. Of course, this government task force is going to have to look at that again, and they say that they're doing a new estimate. I also want to point out that this estimate they just announced is based on information provided to them, not by their own instruments, but by BP. And BP has a vested interest in keeping that leak estimate low because
and not only a vested interest, but a long track record going back to the original thousand gallons a day estimate that came with at the beginning of the leak.
Yeah, and they're going to be charged by the government based on the actual amount of oil that is spilled. So they want their penalties to stay low. Anyway, in the meantime, BP is also wants to pay their shareholders a dividend, which, you know, think about it. A dividend is a distribution of profits to your shareholders. That is,
you do it when times are good.
When times are good and things look bright and you don't have to save money to pay for lawsuits and enormous penalties when you've spilled oil all over the Gulf of Mexico. But I also want to point out, too, that they're thinking of making these payments to their shareholders at a time when folks in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Florida are waiting and waiting and waiting to get their claims paid for damages because of the oil spill. And the government has stepped back and not taken a role in trying to speed those claims through.
And another way to interpret that is that BP is extremely confident that it will have very little liability for this actual spill.
Yeah, and why are they confident? Because they've only spent $1 billion on the cleanup so far, and that's a whole other story. There are a lot of people complaining in Florida and L.A. and Louisiana and Mississippi and places around the Gulf that BP has not been responsive when the oils come knocking on these folks' door. You know, BP has not been there right at hand to help them prevent the oil from coming ashore, and they haven't been around much to help with the cleanup. They've only spent, so far, the company's only spent about $1 billion. Well, last year, their total profit for the year was $17 billion. So there's no excuse for them not to be more proactive and not to be spending more money. They're just keeping that cash in reserve so that they can, well, you know, pay their shareholders.
Tony Hayward needs an extra Learjet. These things take priority.
Oh, yes.
Meanwhile, they have plans for doing a burn-off of the oil.
Yeah, BP is planning to incinerate 420,000 gallons of oil a day on the Gulf. And if people remember the oil fires that accompanied the first Gulf War and what kind of air pollution that results in, the only reason they can get away with this is it's in international waters and there's no actual agency that can monitor the environmental damage that plan will cost. Once again, as with the dispersal of chemicals into the Gulf of the antidispersants and with several other aspects of BP's actions, the actual cures have been far more environmentally devastating even than the original leak has been. And there's been no accountability for this so far. It's really quite alarming.
Yeah, even though we don't know the chemical composition of the chemical dispersants used, we do know that they're petroleum-based. So putting petroleum-based toxic chemicals with a petroleum product is just increasing the pollution.
And care to remind us of why we don't know the chemical composition?
Because they're a trade secret.
All right. Any other items this week related to the oil spill? Or
no, we want to try and cut down on the number of listeners who are gathering around the Aurora Bridge this morning. It's just not a good way to start the morning.
All right. Right. Well, then let's move on to a new Census Bureau report.
Yeah, and a fascinating report this week
by the
Census Bureau on minority Americans. Much of the nation's demographic change in racial composition is seen among kids. In California, minorities make up now 72% of people under the age of 15. Nationally, 46% of children under 15 are non-white compared to 40% in 2000. And in 42 states now, numbers show a loss of non-Hispanic whites under the age of 45. Nationally, that declining by 8.4 million people since 2000. In contrast, the number of states in which the majority of children under 15 are minorities is now 10. And a fourth state, Texas, now has its overall population as more than 50% non-white. What this means politically for this country, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that it means culturally, but what it means politically is that the Republican Party's strategy of appealing to angry white people who are threatened by non-white populations is a demographic dead end, that it may be successful this fall, it may be successful when people are angry about a non-white president, but in the long term, they're going to have to get over it, because the nature of this country is changing.
All right. Moving on, also a report from the Center for Public Integrity.
Yeah, fascinating report also from the Center for Public Integrity, which does a lot of good information. This one on lifetime giving to members of Congress throughout their political careers. And here's a big surprise. Harry Reid, who's the majority Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, who's the minority Senate leader, and John Boehner, who's the minority leader of the House of Representatives, all share the same company that is the largest single giver to their political campaigns. That would be the telecommunications giant AT&T. And this tells us a lot about why, for example, we have warrantless spying was granted retroactive immunity to AT&T and other telecommunications companies in the waning days of the Bush administration a couple of years ago. It also tells us a lot about broadband priorities and why this country has so much slower broadband access than almost every other industrialized country in the world at this point.
All right. Well, that moves us on then to international, starting with Afghanistan.
Yeah, bad week for news in Afghanistan. General McChrystal admitting in a NATO briefing this week that preparations for the so-called offensive in Kandahar are not going according to plan. That offensive earlier this week was downgraded to the United States now saying that it's going to provide government aid and security assistance to the Afghan government in Kandahar. That we're actually not going to try and go in there and bomb the city and blow things up the way we once said we did. And the reason for that is, well, we'd get our butt kicks if we tried it. The other things, we're getting a number of reports coming out now, although it's not been reflected in U.S. media coverage, that the offensive this spring in Marja has been pretty much a complete failure, that something that was supposed to be very quick and sort of a trial run for the offensive in Kandahar this summer is still going on, and that the United States and NATO and Afghan forces have very tenuous control over Marja at this point. Reports also coming out on Monday this week that the training of the Afghan army is way behind schedule and that the U.S. Army has exaggerated the success of those training programs. And oh yes, we also had 10 NATO soldiers, including 7 Americans, and that have died in fighting this week, and our weekly wedding party disaster, 37 Afghan civilians bombed and killed in a wedding party this week, and we wonder why the effort to win hearts and minds just isn't going the way Obama had planned it to.
Yeah, and there was, I think, another report this time in the New York Times about the U.S. paying private security companies, Afghan-based private security companies, to help them transport, well, to help guard their transports of goods along the highways in Afghanistan, and how some of those companies are turning around and paying that U.S. taxpayer money to the Taliban to keep them from attacking U.S. convoys, so that essentially we're funding both sides of the war, our own troops and the enemy troops.
And we're also funding warlords who are running drugs.
Yes.
With the same dynamic.
Yep.
All right.
Three sides in the war.
Yes. Capitalism being the third side.
Yes.
Moving on, China.
Yeah, some good news this week. Actually, we've been hearing more about strikes in China. Evidently, if you talk to any international labor organization, they will tell you that strikes occur very frequently in China, but we don't tend to hear about them because the Chinese government clamps down on reports in the Chinese press on strikes because, China wants that business from foreign multinational corporations. But it's been really hard for them to keep a lid on the strikes at Honda plants that recent 2-week strike at a Honda plant that shut down their operations in China completely. And after they settled that, then 2 more strikes cropped up in Honda auto plants in China, and they are continuing because workers are saying, well, you gave massive raises, 24% to 36% raises to the workers in that first plant. We want the same. In one plant, the workers organize and elected shop stewards and are now demanding that Honda and the Chinese government allow them to form an independent union to represent them and not use the Chinese government union, which, of course, represents foreign corporations. The workers at that plant are mostly women. They're in their 20s. Most of them have a high school education or less. They're paid a minimum wage of $132 per month. That's the minimum wage in the city where they work. The minimum wage in China varies increase from city to city, which is amazing to me. Of course, it's amazing to me that it can vary from state to state in the United States. But the workers there at that Honda plant, they want an 89% raise so that they can make about $250 per month for a 42-hour work week. I think that's extremely reasonable. And I find this very encouraging news that Chinese workers are beginning to organize and are beginning to turn what is the world's factory into a competitive environment when you look at it from the workers' perspective.
All right. Moving on to a report out this week by Amnesty International.
Yeah, not quite as good news on this front. Amnesty International reporting basically United States war crime cluster bomb attack last December in the country of Yemen from a Tomahawk cruise missile on December 17th that killed 55 people in the rural community of Al-Majalla. That included 14 women and 21 children. This was something that was supposedly an attack on an Al-Qaeda training camp, but it turned out to be an attack on a rural community that basically killed everyone in the community. Now, cluster bombs are an anti-personnel type of mine, and to use them in a rural community with a large civilian population present is flat out a war crime, and this type of attack can only be launched on the president's orders. So basically this information, which was not widely reported in American media, surprisingly enough, is that in this particular incident, we have a pretty clear-cut case of Barack Obama being a war criminal, and as well as the people under him who carried out this attack.
Well, and it just points out, too, how terrible this sort of video game war is. I mean, we really need to step back from it and say, you know, this remote way of conducting, you know, attacks against communities, against people in another country where we don't even have men on the ground to see who's actually in the buildings that we're targeting or actually in the areas that we're targeting. That has to stop. That in itself should be illegal.
Absolutely.
All right. And then finally, briefly, a study in the UK related to smoking.
Yes. The British government had imposed a public smoking ban about a year ago, and there's a doctor's group that did a study on what the overall effect of that was, and they found 1,200 fewer admissions for heart attacks in the 12 months after the introduction of the smoking ban. What that means is that they have witnessed the immediate effects of ceasing cigarette smoking. A lot of people are very familiar with the long-term effects of cigarette smoking. They think, well, I'm smoking this thing, I'll die of cancer one day. They don't realize that within 30 minutes after you take your first puff of a cigarette, you begin these chemical changes within your body that can lead very quickly to a heart attack or a stroke. Your blood begins to coagulate. Your veins begin, your blood vessels begin to do interesting things. And it can have, you know, and whether you are the actual person who is having that problem or the person standing next to you is inhaling your secondhand smoke really doesn't matter. Those changes happen immediately. They don't happen 20 years down the road. So I found that to be very, very interesting. And that this research on smoke-free laws and their impacts could have this immediate effect on public health.
Well, and for anybody who's ever actually smoked, and you know that there is a chemical reaction when you take that first puff.
Oh,
there's an actual reaction in how you feel. That's why people like nicotine as a drug. That it's not surprising that the bad effects of it are also immediate.
Yeah.
All right. Events.
Yeah, a couple of events this week to talk about. Today at noon at Westlake, there will be a part of a national day of protest. There will be a protest against BP, both the oil leak and the response thereof. That'll be downtown at Westlake Park, 4th and Pine, at noon today. And then at Wednesday, before the last school board meeting of the school year, there'll be a 5:30 rally and protest at the Glass Palace in SoDo, where the school board has its meetings, by folks wanting to hold the school board and particularly Superintendent Goodloe Johnson accountable for any number of the problematic things that have been happening in the school district this year under her leadership. So that's at 5:30 on Wednesday.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State has a brand new website that we've just rolled out. We're still working out the kinks in it, but it's pretty cool. You should check it out at www.eatthestate.org. And this coming week will be the last regular print edition. We'll still have some special ones from time to time around elections and things like that. But that will be, as they always have been, free of charge. You can find it at bookstores and cafes and places around town. So get that collector's edition. That'll be coming out on June 24th.